From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, the Utah State Legislature is down to its final week of their winter session, and what have they done or planned to do to protect or not to protect the state's air, water, land, and wildlife?
Joining us in the first part of the show to discuss this will be Matt Pacenza, the executive director of the environmental activist group Heal Utah. He'll update us on what Senate and House bills and resolutions have already been passed with respect to our environment and what bills remain under consideration.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll go underground. This winter has been relatively cold and snowy, and we know that animals such as deer, elk, and moose have been put under extra stress to find food and shelter.
But what about the life that goes on beneath our feet? During the warmer months, our soil teems with insects, worms, and bacteria by the trillions. So what happens to soil life during the winter? Does it die? Does it hibernate? Does it freeze?
Or does it go to Scottsdale? Mary Tiedemann is a soil scientist and member of the Soil Science Society of America, and she'll join us in the second part of the show to answer these questions and explain why snow cover is actually important to the survival of soil-based life.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Your kids need clear communication, especially when it comes to alcohol. As parents, be specific. Absolutely no underage drinking. Not one drop of alcohol under any circumstances. Learn more at parentsempowered.org.
Valley Behavioral Health is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Support for KPCW comes from the Waterford School, Utah's secular, independent school, enrolling students preschool through grade 12. Waterford provides a top liberal arts college preparatory education with experienced faculty, rich curriculum, nurturing community, and a beautiful 40-acre campus. Visit waterfordschool.org to schedule a tour. The Waterford School is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone for the first part of the show is Matt Pacenza. He is executive director for Heal Utah, now more than ever. And he's here to talk to us about what's going on in the Utah State Legislature, what bills are up to be passed, what bills may have been passed from the out of the House and the Senate with respect to our environment. Matt, thanks so much for joining us this morning for this update.
My pleasure. Good morning, Chris. Good morning, now.
Hey, so let's just start with the general question of what bills are in play or maybe have already been passed with respect to our air, land, water, energy systems, et cetera.
We'll just keep listing topics.
Yeah,
and
you go.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, there's about 1,000. So this is going to be a 9-hour program, just to warn you all.
Settle in.
Yeah, I actually would say overall that I think it hasn't been the most consequential session when it comes to kind of environmental and health issues, the kind that we keep an eye on. And I think that's honestly both a good thing and a bad thing. So, you know, it's a bad thing because we haven't seen maybe the most ambitious bills pushing forward to make significant changes. At the same time, there haven't also been any bills that we're, you know, appalled by. So that's kind of, you know, the big picture of where we're at. But to be more specific, the vast majority of bills which, you know, we're keeping an eye on are still in play. And that's not uncommon by any stretch. You know, we have a little over a week left, And the reality of a short session legislature is they often bring it right on down to the wire. So, you know, we'll kind of see what happens between now and next Thursday. The two bills that have passed so far and await the governor's signature are actually two that we don't like, and two that we actually held a press conference yesterday with some other groups and are urging him to Governor Herbert, to veto those two bills. So I can go ahead and tell you about those if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Please do.
So, yeah, the first one that people may have heard of, because it's made a decent amount of news, is called HB 11. The title of it is State Boards and Commissions Amendments. And this is the bill that removes language in state law which has required that a whole range of different important boards and commissions are not dominated by a single political party. And so there's a requirement now that when they fill, let's say, the Water Quality Board or the Air Quality Board or the Public Service Commission or any of about 25 other ones, they can't appoint all Republicans, to be totally blunt about it, in a state like Utah. So that language has been removed from the law that governs all 29 boards, and we're pretty concerned about that. We think having political diversity within, let's say, the Air Quality Board or the Public Service Commission, which regulates Rocky Mountain Power, we think that's healthy and thinks that it leads to a more diverse array of opinions, which more fully represents all Utahns. So that bill did unfortunately pass both the House and Senate, and we are urging Governor Herbert to veto it.
So let's put it in an example. So if the Air Quality Board, right now they have some rules or standards as to who they could select with respect to political party or profession or organization?
Yeah, they have both of those things. This bill doesn't affect the part about profession, so it doesn't affect the part that says you need one health expert,
right,
and you need one person representing manufacturing industry. It doesn't affect any of that, but there's a separate piece of state law which says basically that a 50% plus one can't be from a political party. So in this case, a 9-member board, 5 of them can be Republicans, but the other 4 have to be some mix of independents and Democrats and kind of non-affiliated. So it just keeps the, you know, from having a sort of totally dominant single voice on the board.
Do we know where Governor Herbert stands on this at this point?
You know, I'm not sure we do. It's a little bit of, we've gotten some mixed signals. This gets into kind of the weedsy, complicated, wonky part of legislation. But at one point, there was an amendment which pulled out the environmental boards and also pulled out the Public Service Commission. And that amendment was actually passed in the House. And the governor's office was fine with that amendment. So that's an encouraging sign. A less encouraging sign is that overall his office did support the bill. So we'll see. I would describe it as, you know, kind of up in the air a bit.
So again, this would affect boards like Air Quality Board, Water Quality Boards, I assume, Public Utilities Commission,
Public Service Commission.
These are the examples of boards with, you know, would have an environmental perspective that could be impacted.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's quite a few other ones, too. I mean, there's plenty of things out there that folks are concerned about as citizens and should be. So another one that's affected is the alcohol. I always forget the name, but like the Alcohol Beverage Regulation Commission, that
right.
One. So, you know, they decide if a given bar or club or restaurant should get a liquor license, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them on there are kind of mundane. I'm not sure any of us is too concerned if the Republicans dominate the Livestock Commission. You know, so, you know, some of those you look at, you think like, well, you know, maybe it's hard to find a Democrat with a lot of cow knowledge,
right.
You know?
but
hey, I grew up on a sheep farm, so they could always appoint me for the sheep component of
Seems
that.
Seems like a good option.
Okay.
Yeah, totally. I throw my hat in the ring.
Be a lateral move for you. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So that's one bill that has been passed and is going to the governor's desk. You said there was another one.
Yeah, there is another one, and this one is HB 65, Air Conservation Act Amendment, from Representative Mike Schultz. And what this bill does is it forbids our state regulators from making any rules that restrict the burning of wood for food preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So as folks undoubtedly know, we have rules in place that on Red Air days and on the days leading up to Red Air days, you're not supposed to burn wood.
Right.
Now, that rule is not terribly well enforced, but at least it's a guideline, and at least folks are discouraged from, you know, lighting up a big old fire in the fireplace when our wintertime inversions are so bad. Now, that rule is silent on the question as to whether you can, you know, smoke a pork shoulder in your backyard on those days. And the reality is I don't think there are a ton of folks who are doing a lot of that kind of thing in the middle of the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But the barbecue industry apparently has decided that, you know, even the possibility of this coming at some point down the road is too horrible to bear. And so they found a legislator who essentially has written a bill which is now passed, which basically says you can never regulate that. You can never regulate the burning of wood for making food. And, you know, we have a few big problems with it. One of them is that it's written in such a broad way that, as far as we could tell, you could have a giant bonfire in the middle of your backyard, you know, in December on a bad air day. And if you have a hot dog on a stick somewhere lying nearby, well, you know, it turns out you can go ahead and do that.
Sure.
That's one problem. And the bigger problem is kind of a take-a-step-back problem that we just don't think the state legislature should be telling our air quality regulators what they can and cannot do. That, you know, we have a serious air quality problem. It's going to take a wide range of creative solutions. And the last thing we should be doing is saying, you know, well, don't look at this and don't look at that and don't look at this. You know, they should be able to look at everything. And is smoking pork butts going to turn out to be the magic bullet of, you know, air quality reductions? You know,
right.
It probably isn't. But we'd rather they have the ability to kind of take an unfettered look at all the potential sources of pollution.
Well, I was just going to ask, what was the motivation for this? Obviously, you mentioned the barbecue industry, but is the concern mostly about, like, businesses, you know, cooking a
wood-fired
pig
pizzas
on a,
I thought there
you know,
was already
right.
kind of a waiver
this...
for commercial-based restaurants that used wood to, like, say, make pizzas or barbecue.
Yeah, or is this looking at individuals, like you say, you know, throwing something on the grill in the backyard?
Residential-based food preparers.
Yeah.
So Chris has it right, that commercial food preparation, you know, wood-fired pizza, that kind of thing, is already exempt. Now,
right.
It's not exempt in law. It's exempt in rule.
Right.
And so theoretically, the Division of Air Quality could sort of change that rule and you know, go after commercial wood. But we've been told that the impetus for this bill is not that category of folks, but it is, in fact, individuals, households, backyards, that kind of thing. And it comes, we've been told, frankly, from the companies that manufacture, you know, kind of a backyard smoker, you know, a big kind of thing where you would, again, sort of, you know, barbecue, you know, cut a pork or beef or something like that.
So, and like you say, it's written in such broad general terms that if I put a marshmallow over my outdoor fire or a s'more, that could be considered exempt from the wood burning ban for that day, for a red day or something like that.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And I think, you know, we're still trying to settle the science on how serious the problem wood burning is. But, you know, there's been some suggestion it's a bigger part of the problem than
yes.
you might think it is. And I was recently reading, you know, some of your listeners may know this, but I didn't know that one of the more serious air pollution problems in the United States is actually Fairbanks, Alaska. And Fairbanks has a pretty similar problem to the Salt Lake Valleys, where it's essentially kind of in a bowl and geography is part of the problem. And by far the biggest source of the pollution in Fairbanks is wood smoke, that most folks use wood to heat their home. And the reality is if you burn a lot of wood in a crowded urban area, you're going to make a heck of a lot of pollution. So, you know, it is a legitimate concern, and we definitely are hoping that Governor Herbert will veto HB 65.
Okay, so those are the two bills that have passed that you've been kind of watching, and it sounds like there are a whole slew of other things that are still in the mix.
Right.
What are some of the bills that you expect may make it through in these final days of the session?
Yeah, so let's switch and talk about some positive things that, again, still have a few hurdles left to clear, but are bills that we certainly do support. One of them is a bill to bring back the tax credit to support electric vehicles. And so we've had that in place for a number of years, and if you have purchased or leased a new electric vehicle, you've gotten some assistance from the state. That was allowed to lapse at the end of 2016, and HB 29 would bring that back. So that bill has, I believe, made it through the House, and or no, it requires its final House vote and now then has to move on to the Senate. So far it's passed, and we're hopeful, but the clock is ticking.
Okay.
I'll mention another good one, also relating to vehicles and air pollution, which is HB 134, Emissions Testing Amendments. And What this would basically do is that if your county has an emissions testing program, which, you know, every Wasatch Front county does, then it would require that you also test diesel vehicles. And for whatever strange reason, Utah County does not currently test diesel vehicles. And diesels, it turns out, are more likely to fail emissions tests than regular cars. And when they do fail them, they put out quite a bit more pollution than even a regular car does that fails it. So being able to figure out which diesel vehicles are not in compliance is actually a pretty effective way to limit air pollution. So this bill so far has passed the entire House. It faced a very close vote just this past Friday, but it did squeak by. Now it moves into the Senate, so we're hopeful that will pass the Senate as well.
So wait a minute. So right now, in Utah County, just in Utah County, there's no requirement for diesel vehicle owners to have emissions testing.
That's correct. They're exempt. So if you have a diesel vehicle, you would still have to do your safety test, that kind of inspection. But yeah, no emissions testing.
You can go in there with the dirtiest diesel vehicle imaginable, and that would not be a part of your pass or fail.
It would not. No, you could still theoretically get a ticket. You know, there are if you're kind of blatantly belching out black smoke, that theoretically is a ticketable offense. But yeah, you certainly wouldn't be caught by an emissions test.
And this bill is designed to address that, where it would now require diesel vehicle owners. I believe it 1997. If we're talking about the same bill, might be the cutoff for vehicles that are older than 1997 don't require testing. It's vehicles after 19 that would require testing. So this is the bill that addresses that?
Yeah, that's correct. And it would essentially just require that, hey, if you're doing any emissions testing, let's include diesels as well. And as you said, there is a cutoff for the age of the vehicle. There's also some exemptions for vehicles used for agriculture and that kind of thing.
Right. That's encouraging. But that's in play, and we'll see if it gets through the Senate in time, right? But the clock can run out on a lot of these bills, right, Matt?
That's definitely the case, and the nature of having this 45-day session is they just don't get to stuff, and there's plenty of stuff that seems to have support that just doesn't. Doesn't get through. So, they'll go until midnight, that final night, a week from Thursday, and they'll be passing bills at 11:59. It's the darndest thing.
Yeah.
So, the clock definitely could be our enemy for several of these, for sure.
Okay.
So what other, exciting bills or positive bills are out there on the horizon? We like this good news angle.
Sure thing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there's a couple decent solar bills. One we're kind of officially neutral on, but I still think is mostly good news. And then one that we support, the one we do support is SB 154, and that would essentially make it easier for you to have solar if you live in a homeowners association. And so up until now, if you've lived in a homeowners association, that association could essentially tell you you can't have solar, or they could, kind of put so many restrictions on it to make it sort of impossible or expensive, and you would have effectively had no recourse. And so what this bill does is it doesn't mandate that every single HOA has to require solar in exactly the same way, but it gives the members of HOAs rights and narrows the kind of restrictions that HOAs can put in place, and certainly should have the effect overall of making it quite a bit easier to do solar if you are in an HOA.
Well, that's an interesting one. I know that folks in our city and county will be interested in that because HOA regulations have been a challenge for some people in that area.
Big hurdle. Mm-hmm. Big hurdle there. So that's SB 154. What about the other solar tax credits in HB 23?
That's correct, yeah. And that's a bill that we're kind of officially neutral on because in some ways we're a little disappointed in it. But at the same time, I think folks need to appreciate that it's probably a positive overall. And basically, we have an up to a $2,000 state-level tax credit for anyone who installs a residential rooftop solar system. You also get a pretty nice federal-level tax credit for up to 30% of the cost of the system. So that can really help make that system a lot more affordable for families in the state. And the really good news is that there's been a really impressive and sharp increase in the number of families choosing solar. And because of that, the tax credit has started to add up to some pretty significant amount of money. And so a Republican legislator from Ogden, Jeremy Peterson, he felt like it was kind of taking too much out of the state budget. So he introduced a bill which would have phased it out really quickly. And it also would have put, I think worst of all, a hard cap on how much could be spent on the credit each year. So you would have had a really weird situation where the credit would have run out in like February or March and April, and then everyone after that wouldn't have gotten it. So it would have been very kind of awkward for the market and a difficult thing for solar companies. So negotiations ensued. The solar industry was very much involved, and ultimately they came out with a compromise where there's no longer a cap. So every year, everybody who does it can get the credit. And the credit remains at its full level for this year. So in 2017, you get the full $2,000. And then it goes down by $400 each year, and then ultimately would disappear in 2022. So, you know, from Heliotop's perspective, we'd have liked to have seen that full tax credit remain in place indefinitely. You know, we think it's just super important that we push solar out there and ultimately think that's a good use of state money. But in a sort of more pragmatic, practical way, you know, it was starting to mean a fairly significant hit on the state budget. And, you know, overall, the compromise that was crafted is certainly much better than the original bill.
Right. And again, the federal tax credits remain in place.
And it's actually roughly the same timeline, Chris. I can't exactly remember, but that you know, amazingly, our wildly dysfunctional Congress actually agreed to do that a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And they did extend that one as well, and it does also ratchet it down. And it's kind of roughly on that same timeline. It's kind of ends somewhere in the early 2020s. So
okay.
Part of the message, to be honest, I mean, it's not my job to tell people this, but if you're considering getting a rooftop solar system, now's your time.
Right. Now more than ever.
Yep.
That seems to be a recurring theme. So, Matt, a couple more minutes. Anything else that you want to mention bill-wise? Or how about this? How do people, you know, get in touch with their elected officials to weigh in on some of these bills and proposed bills?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the real positives of the Utah legislature is that you know, your representatives are accessible. And, you know, they're not full-time. They're not full-time paid employees. They, you know, they work part-time in these jobs and often have other careers. And, you know, if you look up your legislator and you can go to the state website, which is le.utah.gov, you'll often find their mobile phone right there, you know, and you can literally text them or call them and urge them to do one thing or another. You know, one of the best ways to find out what's happening and how to weigh in is to do it kind of via an advocacy organization like Heal Utah or like another, you know, group that represents your interests in whatever particular issues are most important to you. And so if you sign up for our emails or follow us on Facebook, then, you know, we'll go ahead and let you know, like, hey, this one's coming up tomorrow, and it's important that you reach out to your senator today and ask, you know, him or her to do the following. So, you know, go to that state legislature website, poke around yourself, or kind of sign up for emails from a group like Heal, and we'll kind of clue you in on when the best time is.
Yeah, and that website also kind of has real-time tracking of the bills themselves. So if you really want to know what's happening, the latest of what's happening with a lot, like you say, there are hundreds and hundreds of bills that are in play right now. Go to le.utah.gov. And, of course, come on, shameless plug, Matt, Heal Utah has their own podcast too. Right?
That's right. If you love the sound of my voice, Chris, and you know who doesn't, and we do a weekly show in which we interview folks who have some connection to environmental issues, and spoke to a city councilwoman, Erin Mendenhall, yesterday, and have had a bunch of, you know, interesting people with smart opinions about environmental issues in Utah. So yeah, check out the Heal Utah podcast.
All right, Matt, and your website, healutah.org. Thank you very much. You can go there too and learn and get all the info on what Heal Utah is doing. So Matt, thanks again so much for joining us. Great update. And remember, even those bills that have been passed that are going to the governor, those two bills, HB 11 and HB 65, there's still time to email, call the governor's office and weigh in on your thoughts on HB 11 and HB 65, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, give them a call today. We often urge people to call the governor, unlike some of our congressional folks, they're really good about staffing that office, and they will take your call. So I don't have that number at my fingertips, but I'm sure you all can find it. But, yeah, give the governor a call and you know, let them know what you think, and they'll certainly tally those responses.
Let them know Matt sent you. All right. I'm sure that'll help. Matt Pacenza is executive director with Heal Utah. Thanks again, Matt, for touching base with us, and we'll have you back maybe after the legislature session to do a recap on what did make it and did not make it through these last few days. Thanks again.
That'd be great.
All right, Matt. Let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors, and we come back. We're going to talk soil, right, with a soil scientist?
That's right. Mary Tiedemann is going to talk with us all about soil in winter and what's happening under the snow.
You won't believe it. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Mary from Recycle Utah. Did you know Recycle Utah provides green guidance to local Park City and Summit County businesses? If you are interested in expanding your eco efforts with recycling, water and energy conservation, and more, we're here to help you. Contact Recycle Utah for more information.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years. We support KPCW and the idea of leading sustainable lives in Park City.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us on the phone for the second half of the show today is Mary Tiedemann. She's a soil scientist and is a member of the Soil Science Society of America.
Good job.
Without hesitation. And she's currently pursuing her PhD in soil microbiology at Florida International University and is here to talk with us about soil in winter and what's happening underneath all the snow that we see out there. So, Mary, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Chris and Nell. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this because I'm fascinated by this question. What drew you to this field? Why did you decide to spend your time studying soil?
In the winter. From Florida.
It's a little silly. I've been writing a lot for the Soils Matter blog through the Tri-Societies or the Soil Science Society of America about winter as of late. And I feel like a bit of an imposter because I've been writing from sunny Miami, Florida.
Right.
But I'd like to say I did my time. I'm born and raised in Iowa. And so I spent many years experiencing snow. But I would say that I first got into soils through an interest in environmental science. I did my undergrad and my master's degree at Iowa State University, and they have a very prominent agronomy department there. And it started with a field course I took that went to Ghana, and we investigated how soil resources are influenced by land use change. So we investigated tropical rainforests and the same soils that once were rainforests that had been cultivated, and got to see the dramatic differences in soil quality from comparing these different land uses. And it just was infectious. I came home from my trip and signed up to add soil science to my my bachelor's program.
So let's start with this. as we dig into this, you know, I think it would be helpful for us to have a general profile of like what's in the soil. It's not just, you know, some minerals, some sand, some organic matter.
A couple of worms.
That's right.
Yes.
There's a lot of happening. So kind of explain to us what a soil profile might look like.
Sure. Well, yes, like you said, we've got a mineral component and an organic matter component, as well as gases and water that fill up pore spaces. But a classic soil profile would that you would vision in textbooks and things is going to have horizons. So the colors and the textures and the way that the soil material clumps together is going to change as you dig deeper down the soil profile. And all of these characteristics within a soil profile are shaped by the various forcings that we experience in the environment. So you think of climate and the sorts of organisms, both plant life and animal life, living in the soil, the relief or the topography of a landscape, let's see, climate,
right.
Slope, the parent material, all of these things are very important when we try and investigate the various soil properties that we're trying to predict.
And obviously then, kind of leading up, is soil conditions can change on a seasonal basis, let's say, here out in Utah. Here out in Utah, what would you say is the thickness of our organic layer on average? I asked either you, Mary, or Nell, who's an environmental scientist, what would you say is it's not very thick, the typical organic layer? Is that
sure. Correct? Well, unfortunately, I have never been to Park City, Utah. Mm-hmm. It's on the top of my list, but okay. I haven't been able to dig around in the soils there. I do understand, obviously, that you have some tremendous slopes in your area, and in preparation for this meeting, I pulled up some soil maps just to give myself a little bit of a context, and I was surprised to see that you have mollisols in your area, which are relatively high in organic matter soils, and I saw that they ranged from between 3 to 7% organic matter, which is, you know, from a perspective of global soils, that's a quite a high amount of organic matter.
Huh.
But that's as far as I can go from my own perspective.
Well, I would just add to that. I think that the depth of that layer in the soils is so variable spatially. Like in some places, you're going to have a really deep layer, like maybe in the bottom of a basin,
right.
In a well, and down in the desert, you have next to nothing.
Nothing.
Right.
But meanwhile, in Swanner Preserve, a wetland-based system, it's
bottomless.
Pretty beefy.
It's
pretty beefy. Okay. So
right, and that's what's one pretty interesting thing about soils is how spatially variable they are. When I say that the landscape relief is an important aspect of soil formation, that's one example where you say that you find more organic soils in basins versus side slopes. You're going to have a lot less organic matter because erosion and gravitational forcings are a major force in those high slope areas.
Right. Okay.
So I would love to talk a little bit about the living component of our soils. From what I understand, there's so much more going on in those soils than meets the eye as far as bacteria and similar things. So can you explain that?
Yeah. So we can think of, if you just kind of go to your imagination, you can think offhand, of course, a lot of places have earthworms and ants and gophers, mice, so on and so forth. There's a ton of organisms that we could kind of obviously draw to that live in the soil. But there's also a tremendous amount of soil bacteria and fungi and algae and smaller organisms like nematodes that are either impossible to see by the naked eye or, you know, very, you know, they're tiny.
And right.
So it's easy not to acknowledge that those exist, you know, because we don't think of them as often. But a fun fact about soil biology that soil scientists like to throw around quite a bit is that if you take just a few teaspoons of soil, mm-hmm. You could find more organisms than there are people on the planet.
Wow.
Okay. that's a collective wow.
Right.
That's billions.
It's kind of tremendous.
Billions and billions of organisms
exactly.
within a couple of teaspoons of typical soil.
Not
tropical or highly active soil, just typical soil. Okay. They're all in there. They're trying to get along in one one way or another. Maybe they collaborate in, you know, in some fashion too. So what are they doing during the winter? Are they settling down? Do they die? Do they freeze? What goes on with all these nematodes and bacteria and fungi, mold, et cetera?
Sure. Well, I would imagine that some of them die. Some organisms have pretty short life cycles. Mm. But an important thing to know is that the soil is there to protect its organisms. So soils have all sorts of functions within an ecosystem, and they can bring in quite a bit of insulation for soil organisms, especially if there are soils that are high in organic matter or have a large amount of vegetative cover in snow. And so the nice thing is when it gets cold out, I'm sure everyone's familiar with the frost layer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a portion of the soil that will have completely frozen water. And it starts from the surface of the soil and goes downward. And the depth of that frost layer depends on the amount of organic matter and cover and snow. And organisms are able to live below that frost layer and can surprisingly remain fairly active in the wintertime.
So if you took a couple of samples of soil right now out of my backyard, put it on a microscope, I would see activity in some form.
Potentially, depending on how deep you dig.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And yeah. So you mentioned that the snow plays an important role in, you know, insulating the ground. Tell us a little bit more about that, about the importance of snow, like in a cold climate like Park City.
Yeah. So snow is tremendously important, especially for areas with steep slopes, with quite a lot of vulnerability to erosion. The snow serves a number of different roles. First and foremost, that I had mentioned before, this idea of insulation. If snow falls early enough in the fall, when the temperatures haven't consistently been too cold, they can actually trap heat that's been stored in the soil through the summer and fall, well, and spring, of course. The snow can trap this heat that's been stored over the 9-month period, as well as prevent cold air from flowing in and penetrating the soil.
Okay.
And so, yeah, this helps reduce the frost layer or the depth at which the soil is completely frozen. And also, it's very important in the springtime when the snow starts to melt, because if the frost layer is thinner, which would happen if you had adequate snow cover, then the soils will thaw more quickly, and they'll be able to take in and store that snow melt, where otherwise, if the snow is starting to melt and the soils are still frozen solid, that water has nowhere to go into the soil and will only pool and run off the soil surface, which can have, you know, some serious erosion implications.
That's an important one for us to think about here. There's always a question about what is the runoff going to look like in the spring? Will it happen all at once? Will we be flooding, you know, every stream and reservoir?
And so that rate of runoff benefits soil mechanics, soil ecosystems.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely.
And then, like you say, the absence of snow on the ground during the winter, it just puts the soil ecosystems at greater risk for freezing and damage to their health and welfare. Okay. So let's talk, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Mary Tiedemann. She is a soil scientist. We're talking about, well, soil. And most importantly, what goes on, like I keep referring to the ecosystem or the biosystems within soil, how do they survive the winter? How do they make it through? Let's turn our attention to root systems, because I found this interesting. You write about how roots, plant roots, survive, in effect, the winter, because roots do what? They bring up water. They draw up water during the spring and the summer and the fall. But in the winter, they do something else because they don't want water necessarily in their root systems. Is that correct?
Yes. So roots can actually expel water in a mechanism to protect themselves from freezing. Hmm. Because if that water was left inside the root cell, it would, just like when you fill up an ice cube tray and put it in the freezer, you can notice that water expands as it freezes, and the same process happens everywhere. And so that excess water in a root can become a liability if it's about to freeze. So roots can release water as an extra protection against freezing and damaging their cells.
Interesting.
Those kinds of mechanisms are super interesting. I read that some of these organisms, smaller, you know, microorganisms, remain even active in like frozen ground, in the permafrost, where everything is sort of this hard freeze. How does that work? How do these organisms continue to function in a frozen soil?
It's pretty incredible, right? The things that we take for granted, these organisms are amazingly tough. So one reaction that occurs in soils is an adsorption reaction with clay particles, which means water and clay particles interact in a way that clay will tightly hold water to its mineral surface. And this bond is so strong we call it the hygroscopic water, that microscopic layer of water that's bound to clay minerals actually stays liquid regardless. I mean, there's a threshold, but it will stay liquid up to very cold temperatures. And microbes have managed to discover this, and they access that water and are able to thrive in very cold environments for that reason.
So are they actually kind of producing their own antifreeze? I know some bugs do that. We have big bark beetle problems out here, and one of the ways bark beetles survive the winter is, in effect, produce chemicals that mimic antifreeze. Is that what's going on with some of this bacteria in soil?
It is a possibility. I myself can't infer. That's a little beyond my expertise. Mm-hmm. But I do know that root systems, another mechanism that protects them from freezing in the wintertime, is to concentrate salts and sugars within their roots. For that same reason, the solution is at a higher concentration and requires a lower freezing point. So specific microbes, I'm not exactly sure, but I definitely know that like you said, bark beetles. I know that there are some examples of frogs that do it. I wouldn't be surprised. Mm. Anyways.
Right. Okay.
So we're talking a lot about these microbes in the soil. Why does it matter, I guess? What, you know, role do they play? Why are they important to have, or are they important to have in our soils?
Well, I think this goes back to, or my answer kind of goes back to why I became interested in soil microbes in the first place. It's just the more and more that I've learned over time, I've realized that in regards to soils, microbes are everything. Like, they aid in plant growth, they cycle nutrients, and they retain nutrients. They build up soil organic matter in certain environments, and they consume great deals of organic matter in other environments. The influence of microbes on soils is just tremendous. You know, we can even observe how soils are different in areas without specific populations of soil organisms versus areas thriving with soil organisms. So in general, microbes play such a tremendous role. And what's exciting is that there's so much that we don't know. And so there's just so much opportunity for discovery and understanding within the realm of soil microbiology.
Well, that makes me think of something. You're being from Iowa, surrounded by farmland, large industrial type farming systems. We know that farmers there supplement soils with nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium fertilizer. They add herbicides, pesticides, et cetera. Do they also supplement the soil with microbes?
So that's an interesting topic, and one that is being developed. The efficacy of certain microbial products is still being investigated. There's, like I said, there's so much that we don't know, and so many opportunities to apply knowledge of microorganisms to agricultural landscapes. One thing that we do know is that the greater the soil conservation practice that one applies to their soils, mm-hmm. the healthier they'll be. And a large component of that is the microbial populations within it. So it's not necessarily that you need to apply one specific type of fungus to an ag field for it to function more healthfully. It's a whole holistic process where you apply cover crops and you reduce your tillage and so on and so forth. And over time, you start to build organic matter, which starts to kind of encourage beneficial organisms to grow on your landscape.
Right. Okay, so, just a couple minutes.
Yeah, we've got just a couple minutes left. And I wanted to touch on climate change and how a climate, you know, that's changing with maybe a different water cycle or different temperatures might impact the soil and these microbe communities.
So what's really interesting about climate change, unfortunately, we don't necessarily know how the climate is going to change in every specific area. And that's why research is so important. We have possible inferences as to how things are going to change, but we really can't say anything affirmatively until more research has been done. And also, I'm not a climate scientist, so I wouldn't want to delve too far out into a topic I'm not as familiar with.
Fair enough.
But especially, like, Utah, per se, if precipitation continues to change and you get more rain during the winter months and more fluctuations in the temperature, then one could predict that you might be dealing with greater levels of erosion.
Right. at least greater levels of erosion.
Sure.
So, all right, so a lot to talk about there. Maybe another conversation.
Sure. Well, I do have to say, if I could make a quick plug, the Soil Science Society of America is a sponsor of a documentary project by a soil scientist, David Weindorf, out of Texas Tech, and Paul Allen Hutton. And the title is Between Earth and Sky, and it's an investigation of climate change in Alaska.
Okay.
And that's coming out shortly. There are a number of environmental film festivals that where it will be circulating. So that's one great resource if you're interested in climate change and soil.
Fantastic. And then I wanted to also mention the blog on the website that you write for. Can you give us that URL quickly?
It is Soils Matter, SOILSMATTER.
Okay.
Fantastic. Well, that was Mary Tiedemann, a soil scientist, member of the Soil Science Society of America. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about soils and soils in winter.
Thanks. Great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Mary.
It.
Thank you. Let's take one more break for some underwriters and sponsors, and we'll be back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel. 565-4730, ParkCityAirCruiseAndTravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, ParkCityBikeDemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hey, time to wrap up on This Green Earth. But now, you have a couple items you want to get in real quick?
Well, we have, I'll just do one in this minute. We have a really fun event coming up at the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center this Saturday, March 4th, during normal open hours from 10 to 4 p.m. And it's called the Swanner Snowcase, like showcase, get it?
No.
And this is an event for all Swanner constituents, our community members, and it's an open house. There will be free rentals of cross-country skis and snowshoes and guided tours throughout the day. The climbing wall will be open all day, all kinds of fun things. So come in and check it out. All the details are on the website. SwannerEcoCenter.org.
Members, non-members,
yeah.
Future members.
That's right. Aggie alums, USU alumni are welcome. Oh. We're part of Utah State University, so you're very welcome
Super.
To come on in. Yeah.
And you should play this music the entire time.
So we all feel
oh my God, this
peaceful.
Is,
yeah. Happy.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
It's well, time to wrap up.
Speaking of happy, it's time to wrap up.
Want to thank our underwriters for making this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
Vail Epic Promise,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain.
Of course, you can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
Email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City, and we've got your Wasatch back. Thanks again for joining us. NPR News is right now.